example. Yeah, so the simplest example is take the simplest conformal transformation, the Santa Poincaré transformation. And so first of all, there is one answer, which is this is the only way in which to realize the conformal transformations on field. That's not a very physical answer. Just like you could say, why do fields conform under Poincaré transformations the way they do? Because that's essentially the only way they can do it. But more intuitively, is look under dilatations. Under dilatations, a scalar field that has a certain dimension carries some charge under the dilatation operator, right? So in fact, I think that in one of the first tutorials, you were supposed to check that phi to the 4 in four dimensions was invariant under conformal transformation. So in particular, it was invariant under dilatation. So let's talk on the dilatation, which is the most simplest conformal transformation. So I mean, I think I wrote this yesterday. So there is a piece of the transformation which is just the geometrical piece. And then there is a second piece which tells you precisely what is the charge of phi under the dilatation operator. And that gives you this extra piece, delta phi. Okay. And now, if you, and the question is, where does this come from the point of view of a tensor? If you write down the tensor, so how does, under a coordinate transformation, a scalar transforms, our ordinary scalar transforms as this, right? So it would be, right? But now if you look at the infinitesimal form of the transformation, this guy would only generate this piece. Is that clear? Okay, maybe we can put it into steps, so. Imagine I take x tilde to be x minus epsilon x. So this is a small dilatation. This guy's going to give me phi tilde of x. OK, I chose the sign just to be consistent with the sign, but it doesn't really matter, of course. Minus epsilon x mu the mu phi of x. I just expanded the field at the new point, is equal to phi of x. Okay, so if the field has no weight, has no trivial Jacobian factor, under dilatation, it would have zero eigenvalue. You would only get the orbital part of the transformation. Okay. So the only way you can introduce a non-trivial quantum number under dilatations is by including here this Jacobian factor and expanding to leading order, and then you would recover what you expect, which is exactly the fact that now the field has a dimension, even at the origin. So the field has a non-trivial transformation under dilatation. Does that more or less motivate? For the finite transformation, it also motivates the fact that if you fields that are conformal tensors scale homogeneously with respect to the scale factor. So if you do the finite transformation, then let me write it this way. I guess that's how I wrote it in class. So here is the inverse transformation, right? If I write it this way. And then here you would get lambda mod 2 minus delta. So scaling fields that transform nicely under scale transformation are fields that transform homogeneously under such a transformation. just multiply the field by a scale factor. Notice that one important property of this primary conformal field is that if I make a conformal transformation, the conformal transformation just rotates the fields in that multiplet among themselves. Okay? It doesn't kick you out of the set of fields. So here, phi maps into phi. And I will write an example in which the descendant, in which that property is not true. So if I make a conformal transformation of a field that's not a primary, under conformal transformations, it will kick you out of that set of fields to, in fact, it will give you the primary where the descendant came from. More questions? So no one is asking, but I understood that yesterday there was some confusion perhaps about this R matrix that I discussed. Maybe let me just go through it again quickly. I made a statement in class, and maybe that was a bit fast. I made a statement that there was a very nice way of thinking of transformations and the conformal transformations of primary fields, essentially just by writing down a very slight generalization of how fields transform under Lorentz transformations by introducing an orthogonal x-dependent matrix. And maybe it wasn't completely clear where that matrix came from. So let's see how that arose. Just quickly, so let me write this formula that I wrote many times, but life. So we're looking at the behavior of states, well, so far mainly states and operators and their conformal transformations. And we've derived many times that this is the statement that x tilde as a function of x is a conformal transformation. It preserves a metric up to scale. And notice that I can do something quite elementary. I can bring this omega to the other side and write it like this. So if now I just relabel this as some lambda hat mu rho, well, okay, let me call lambda hat, let me call it precisely R. This is exactly the R matrix I define. This is R mu rho, R mu sigma. Then this precisely looks like a Lorentz transformation, right? I mean, this is nothing but the definition of a Lorentz transformation, because it's a transformation that preserves the metric, literally preserves the metric. Yeah. So this R satisfies this equation. So R is an x-dependent Lorentz transformation. And the reason it was useful to describe, to introduce this matrix, is that then fields transform very nicely. Essentially, they transform identically up to this Jacobian factor that knows about the dimension of the field. So let's ignore that for a second. So imagine you had an operator that has charge zero under the dilatation, then you would just write down the formula that we wrote for Lorentz transformation. So this was, I remember, the representation matrix under Lorentz group, of Lorentz group. So the only modification that we have to do when we have conformal transformations is that instead of putting here just the usual constant Lorentz matrix. Here we introduce this R matrix. And then, as I explained there, the thing that you have to enrich this with is the possibility that phi has a non-zero quantum number under dilatation. And that's captured by this guy. That was the reason we compactly wrote things this way, to make it essentially look like a slight modification of a Lorentz transformation, and also to make it look like the kind of transformation that you would do in general relativity if you had an object that was a density. A density, again, is an object that transforms with a non-trivial Jacobian factor, like the Levi-Civita tensor or the determinant of the metric. And then we wrote the infinitesimal form. I'm going to write it down because we'll use it later. And for the infinitesimal form, what we have to do is the usual thing. So we have a small transformation. V is this famous conformal Killing vector that we derived that parameterizes the set of all conformal transformations. It's a function of these parameters, A, lambda, A mu, lambda, b, and omega mu, no? It's a function of the parameter that controls the translations, dilatations, the special conformal transformations, and the Lorentz transformations. People want, I can write it again, but they wrote it in my mind. This should do. And now what you have to do is expand that equation. Leading order, and then we get something that again is very similar to what you would get for a Lorentz transformation, except that now it has an extra piece because to specify a conformal field, we have to specify one more quantum number. We have to specify Lorentz representation, but also the quantum number under dilatation. So there is this extra piece. We're just to write it down explicitly. Well, V I'm not going to write, this is a conformal Killing vector. This omega mu x is obtained by expanding essentially R. So you get something like minus 1/2 which has the usual Lorentz transformation. So if you make a Lorentz transformation, of course, this formula should reduce exactly to the usual transformation of under the Lorentz group. So you get the Lorentz transformation parameter, except that in this case, B, which remember parameterizes the special conformal transformations, also contributes to a local, which is a function of x, Lorentz transformation, induced Lorentz transformation. And then this omega x is the dilatation. It's associated to the conformal factor, which was 1 over d times the divergence of b, which of course only knows about the non-Poincaré transformation. So you get a scale transformation and a contribution, again, x-dependent from the special conformal transformation. Okay. One thing to notice is that if I evaluate, so remember that So we derived this from the finite form of the transformation just expanding. Another way you could have derived this from first principles, and I guess in the exercise yesterday you saw a hint of how to do it, and actually I did it in the lecture for Poincaré transformation, is that you could have started by looking at the transformations that leave the field at the origin invariant. then you have to specify the quantum numbers of the field under those transformations that leave the origin invariant. We listed what those are, right? It was dilatations, rotations, and a special conformal transformation. Then I said that for primaries, operators are special operators for which the action of a special conformal transformation is trivial, so they have a trivial quantum number under a special conformal transformation. And all that I have to specify are the Lorentz representation R and the dilatation. And then generalizing the calculation I did yesterday for Lorentz transformation, you could then obtain the transformation under any generator Q. Q is any of those guys, so it could be Lorentz transformations, dilatations, or special conformal transformations. You could obtain the transformation at any point from the knowledge of the transformation at the origin. From the knowledge of the transformation at the origin under dilatation. So this is the eigenvalue. This is the scaling dimension of phi. And under, now I want to do a Lorentz transformation. Sorry, this is zero. So from the knowledge of these two, you should be able to, by conjugating with translations, you should be able to derive the transformation of the field under any of these guys away from the origin. And if you want to do the exercise, I mean, it's conceptually straightforward, but you have to do a little bit of a calculation of commuting generators through. You should be able to exactly derive this formula with these coefficients. Is the logic at least clear how you would do this? Silence means yes or no? Sorry? Okay, that means no. Does that mean no? Maybe you can translate.
No.
Good. I want brave people here. That's very good. Okay, so let's. So let me start writing down some formulas and tell me at which point you disagree. Then we can fight over it. So do we agree with this formula? Okay. Okay, now I have to remember that. So we're in the minus, plus, plus, plus. Have to put e to the minus I t mu x mu. And here, e to the I t mu. Are we happy with this formula? Yes? Okay, so then if we are happy with this formula, yesterday I did some manipulations of now plugging this expression of the behavior of the field at this place from the origin by plugging this into here, okay? And then I have the transformation under Q, which is one of those guys, in terms of the transformation, as a function of the transformation of the field at the origin. So doing what essentially I did yesterday, so I have Q. Okay, let me write. I always have to worry about the sign. Yes?
Yesterday you had popular sign.
Yes. So is it clear why the sign is this sign?
Not really.
Not really? Okay, so So this, of course, depends on what your convention, if you're in the mostly plus or mostly minus signature. But something that you know from from your tender youth is in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you know that phi t, OK, tell me, what are the signs for it? Phi of t as a function of phi of zero. Okay, I'm still waiting for the sign. I can multitask. Not much, but a little bit. Sorry? Yes, I have phi of t equals higher or later the position operator, say, at time t to the position operator at time zero.
What metric are you working
on? I'm doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics, so it is the metric.
E to the minus first.
Sorry?
E to minus IH.
Well, there are two choices, so which one?
E to IH.
Okay. Notice that if you do this, this will give you the standard Heisenberg equation of Moshe differentiated with respect to t, and that fixes the sign once and for all. For translations, for special translations, this is different, right? So this would be okay. So now, if I'm in the minus plus plus plus, okay. Imagine we're in four dimensions, just to be concrete. Doesn't matter, of course. Then p mu x mu is minus h. T plus, okay, right? That's clear? Since the minus sign is in the time component, I have to change the sign of the zero component of the inner product of P with X. So therefore, now we can go back here and notice that indeed I get e to the minus IHT. So I would be very surprised that I wrote the sign here with a minus, but I'm a human, so I can make a mistake. But I'm pretty sure that this is what I wrote. Okay, so then, but here I was making a mess, I think, probably then. So okay, so is this point clear at least? Why the sign is what I wrote? If not, speak up, I mean.
Now you started to write the
data. Yes, but all I was doing is substituting phi at x in terms of phi at zero, because I know how phi at zero transforms. I'm done with it. Okay, to be pedantic, for a primary. So all I'm doing is, okay, so I'm substituting this here. Let me write something down and then I'll probably correct it. Q is, again, any of the transformations. I'm running out of space. We'll barely make it. Do we agree that this formula is the same as this formula under the substitution? Look at it, and if you disagree, fight over it. Is that a yes or yes?
Can you explain again why for primaries the commutation of K mu and
that's in a way the defining property of what a primary operator is. And I can give a physical reasoning why this has to happen. But maybe let's postpone that discussion for a second. Let's first conclude this. So are we happy with this? Yes?
you just want to write also that delta phi A
yes.
is equal to that commutator?
The transformations of a field under any symmetry are generated by the charge that generates that symmetry with the field. That's true even in classical mechanics, except that there you would put some brackets as opposed to commutator. Okay, so since no one is disagreeing, then all I'm saying is that now you can use the commutation relations that I gave you for the generators of the conformal algebra, so the commutators of P's, K's, D's, and M's, to calculate this using the Baker blah, blah, blah formula. This will give you a linear combination. Of course, since doing this conjugation by translations will give you generators, which are, of course, in the conformal algebra. I mean, this is an algebra, so if you conjugate, you're only going to get back generators that were in the algebra. But now these generators in the algebra are just act on phi zero, but we know exactly how all generators act on phi zero, right? So I know the transformation. And now all I have to do at the end is use this formula back again. So I'll get something that will be some linear combination of these transformations at the origin, and then I conjugate again by translations. So that's going to move my phi of zero to phi of x again. Okay? And therefore, you will end up with that formula. Is the logic clear? I mean, it should be very clear. OK. Good. Before answering why a primary, why you would want an operator that's annihilated by k mu, I mean, the answer will be very similar to the same reason why you want a state to be annihilated by an annihilation operator. Otherwise, the energy would be unbounded from below, but let's postpone that for a second. Before that, let me just give you an example of a descendant field. So remember that here are the list of nice operators under conformal transformations, but I can always, if I have an operator, I can always take derivatives of the operator. I'm free to do that. These are also operators in our that act on our Hilbert space. So I can consider the mu. Imagine I consider phi is a scalar operator of dimension delta. So I specify the Lorentz and the dilatation quantum numbers. Now, the point is that if I consider this descendant operator, which is just obtained by just taking a derivative, I can always take derivatives of operators to get a new operator, we will see that this operator no longer transforms nicely under under conformal transformations. Not transforming nicely means that when I transform the fields, when I transform this field here, I will get not only this field on the right-hand side, but I will get where it came from. I will get a piece which will be proportional to phi of x. Notice that there, if I evaluate the operator at the origin, so let's put that variation at the origin, the first term vanishes, right, under these transformations, under this. The ones that fit the origin. The transformation of that field at the origin gives you back a rotated version of the field at the origin. There's a Lorentz rotated version of the field and a scaled version of the field. Here, this will not be true. If I calculate this now, this just boils down taking just the derivative of that transformation. It's not nothing more than that. Let me just write down the answer. So far, so good. This looks very similar to how a primary would transform. Even now, even this term looks good. So let's recognize these terms. This is just the orbital piece that you shifted this operator by a certain amount v. This term encodes the intuition that you already had, that if phi has dimension delta, the derivative of phi will have to have dimension delta plus 1. Right, because derivatives cost you one unit of energy, or dimension. So you get delta plus 1. And this term just tells you that even though phi was a scalar, of course, the derivative of phi is not a scalar, it's a vector. There's one index floating around here. Okay. So, and notice that okay, and then the point is that there is an extra piece. Which is induced if you make a special conformal transformation that tells you that this field doesn't close onto itself, but it generates, it knows about where it came from. It knows that if you make a conformal transformation, you go back to the primary. This is a statement that this field is in a non-trivial multiplet of conformal transformations because it's not closed under conformal transformations. If I make a conformal transformation of this guy, I generate another operator. Okay. And notice that this is an example of an operator that one way that we can see that it is not a primary. Well, from many points of view, from the finite form or from the infinitesimal form, is that now if I do the transformation of the field under a special conformal transformation, it is no longer zero. I get a non-zero piece here. Okay, so this field is not a primary; it's a descendant. Okay. And now you can continue taking more derivatives. But at the end of the day, it all boils down to when you list all your operators in the theory, they're either primary or descendants, and the descendants are just straightforwardly obtained from the primaries by just taking derivatives. And even though the transformation properties are messy, they're completely determined by the properties of the primary. Yes?
Well, I didn't get why did you say that is a descendant operator, that big mu?
Because let's evaluate this at the origin. Let's see how derivative of phi at the origin transforms under a special conformal transformation. It's not zero anymore. There is this annoying term. Well, not annoying. And this is the statement that under a special conformal transformation, this operator mixes with the primary. So you start with here, you act with it, and you generate another operator. So they're in a bigger multiplet. So these guys are in some multiplet.
I think there's some issue with indices here.
Oh. Oh, let me see. What am I doing? Okay, I guess what I want to say. Okay. Notice that from this calculation we saw that under dilatation, indeed this guy transforms as you would expect. It has dimension d plus 1. Another way of saying that is as follows. That it's a direct consequence of the conformal algebra. Remember that I said that there were these two important commutation relations of the dilatation operator with the translation generator. This was a statement that P raises, well, we'll see now explicitly what. Sorry. That P is a raising operator. For the dilatation. That increases the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator by 1. While K mu has the opposite sign. So K mu is a lowering. Operator. Okay. So now what I want to see is the following. So let's check that indeed d mu phi, which is a descendant, is can be thought of as just p mu acting on phi of x, right? Because you represent the translation generator by a derivative. So now I want to, let's calculate and let's see if it fits here. It's a challenge, but let's try. So I want to calculate now if phi has dimension delta. So delta is the dimension of phi. The question is, what is the dimension of p mu phi? Okay? So do this carefully. Well, try at least. So essentially what we want to compute is the commutator of dilatations with this new operator. So how would you compute this now? And we have this knowledge. We know the properties of the conformal algebra, how the generators, how much charge they carry under dilatation. We know that the quantum number of the operator phi under dilatation. So we want to calculate the quantum number of this descendant operator under dilatation. So how would you do it? Yes? Use the Jacobi identity. So, I'm assuming that if you don't know what the Jacobi identity, tell me. Otherwise, I'll assume that you know what it is. So all I have to do is move things around a little bit. P mu phi d. OK. So we'll fail. It will not fit here, but it happens. OK? So all I did is use Jacobi identity. It's the fact, maybe you're more familiar, that if I move the guys on the right-hand side to the left, it's just a statement that the sum of the three orderings of the commutators vanishes. That's just a consistency. That's a consequence of the fact that you have a Lie algebra.
Can you have a question?
Yes.
We are using a commutators on the Jacobi identity, but it would, because there are operators, they are operators, but will there be any way to treat them as states and just use the normal, what if we do of it, try to see the eigenvalue of D of this state and then?
Yes, because I mean, the way you would create a state, and this will discuss more how you, so far I'm talking about operators in conformal field theory. At some point, we'll describe how you construct the Hilbert space of a conformal field theory. But I'll postpone that discussion in two dimensions where there are less confusions about indices and stuff like that. And indeed, the way you construct states is just by acting with the operators on the vacuum. So it definitely will have the interpretation of measuring the eigenvalue of the state will be the consequence of the fact that that state is created by this commutator of operators. OK, so let me finish this quickly. So here, I can write this. It's more natural to change the ordering here. So I get plus p mu d phi. I mean, the reason I'm doing this is that I know what the commutator of d phi is. And here, I can change, I get two signs because I move this guy to this side. Okay, let me not go so fast. So let's first evaluate this first term. The first term is going to give me minus I delta, the commutator of P mu with phi. Okay, so I get minus I delta times the operator that I started. And now we have to calculate this guy. Now I use the fact that d with p mu is minus I p mu, so I get plus I phi p mu, which is the same as, of course, minus commutator with p on the left. So indeed, you get that this has so this shows that it's a consequence of the fact that phi has a definite scaling dimension, and the fact that the p has a scaling with 1. It's a few lines to indeed derive that this descendant operator has a dimension that's completely determined in terms of the original dimension of the primary, and just increases the dimension by 1. A completely analogous analysis will show you that K mu, so P mu raises the dimension of delta. Delta, for us, the dilatation operator has an interpretation of, we will see, as a Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian whose spectrum we want to diagonalize. This is what will control the critical exponent. And this is lowers the dimension of delta. I guess, okay, of the operator, right? So now it's quite clear that physically you want to impose the constraint. So you imagine you start in one of these towers, you start with the state, and you start hitting it with k's. So you keep lowering the energy, lowering the energy, lowering the energy. If you want to have energy bounded from below, so there is a minimum energy state, energy as measured with respect to the dilatation operator, it means that at some point when you go down, there has to be an operator or a state that will be killed. By the lowering operator. If that state didn't exist, you would have energy embedded from below, and that would be a physical situation. So the reason for the existence of these primary operators is precisely as ground states for each of these conformal towers. If they didn't exist, it would be kind of a slightly physical situation.
Why did we take it as to be phi at zero space time for it?
Well, because K mu away from the origin is non-trivial, right? Even for a primary, it has this funny x dependence due to this conjugation I was talking about. Okay. So are you more or less convinced that of what? Of that that we understand what the basic operators in CFT are, how they transform, and that we know how to construct the properties of older descendants. And we gave a very direct interpretation of what these operators do to the scaling dimension of the operators. So now the next thing I want to start doing is, now that we know how the operators in the theory transform, we want to determine the constraints imposed by conformal invariants on correlation functions. Okay. Okay. And given that the properties of the descendants, which are just essentially taking derivatives, are quite clearly obtainable from the properties of the primaries. We can just focus on the behavior of the correlation functions for the primaries, because if we know the correlation function of the primaries, by taking a few derivatives here and there, we will immediately deduce the transformation properties for the descendants. So what we want to study is the constraints of conformal symmetry imposed on a correlation function of, say, n primary operators. So you have O1 at x1, O2 at x2, O n at xn. So we have what in whatever dimension you prefer, and we insert operators at n distinguished points. Okay. For the time being, to make my life simpler, I will consider n primary operators that will be scalars. Okay, now for the time being, let me keep them general, and when I'm going to do the specific analysis, I will focus mainly on scalars. There is no real fundamental difficulty in not considering scalars, but then you have to worry about extra indices, and I want to separate the effect of the geometrical transformation from the effect on the spin part of the transformation. So the first question we want to ask is, we're in a conformal field theory. That means that correlation functions are invariant under conformal transformation. Okay. So one question to you would be, how would you characterize this statement, namely that the correlation functions are invariant under conformal transformation? What does that mean? You should have some intuition of this from other courses in physics. What does it mean that something is invariant under conformal transformation or under any transformation?
Transform the coordinates in which fields are taken.
Sorry?
If we transform the points in which fields are taken, do we have to transform also the fields themselves?
Yes. So the statement is, when are two, I mean, you should also have some intuition. When are two things the same after a transformation? Is that if I have some object and I transform it, what you want to see is whether the transformed object and the original object are the same or not, evaluated at the same point. It only makes sense to compare things at the same point. Comparing here things here and in the moon doesn't make sense. But it makes sense to see how the behavior of the correlator, once you transform the fields and you evaluate at the original point, how are they related to the original correlator. So in formulas, the statement of invariance is a statement that this should be the same as Why I don't need this index, right? Why do I keep this index? Well, okay, I need because they could be different operators. Yeah. So they could be many. This is a statement that something is a symmetry. Is this clear? I mean, you should have some intuition of this from GR courses or from a general course. That you transform, of course, under a transformation, your observables change, but then you have to compare it at the same location to see whether they're the same or not. So now, essentially, what we want to exploit is this equation for conformal invariance. So this, of course, this equation would be true for any symmetry. It could be an internal symmetry. If it was an internal symmetry, it wouldn't act on space-time points. Could yes.
I think like if something is invariant under some transformation, it's given. Like it's a physical quantity that I can measure.
Well, this is a physical quantity. A correlation function is an observable. Yes.
What does it represent?
Why don't we also have tildes over the x-axis on the right-hand side?
Sorry?
why there are no deltas over any positions on the right?
Because that would be comparing things at different points. In order to say that some two things are the same, you have to evaluate at the same point.
Aren't they the same physical point?
Sorry?
Aren't they the same physical point, x and x?
No. Because I did a transformation of
did you do active or passive?
Active. I'm an active kind of. Yes, so this is an, this is something that you have to come to grips, this business of active versus passive. And you have to understand it in your own way, but definitely I always have in mind an active transformation. I like to move the table from here to there, not to rotate or, I don't know, the coordinate system. Good. So essentially, you want to compare O of X to O. So we know how to evaluate O at O tilde of X, but then you can pull it back to the original point. And you want to compare pulling back the transform operator at the original point, and that's essentially this data. Okay, here I should have a correlator, right? Okay, and you were asking what the correlation functions measure?
Yeah, physically.
Yeah, so they measure, so in a magnet, it tells you that if you are you have a spin here, okay, you have a big magnet, you have a spin here. You want to see how the fact that this spin is up here, how likely it is the spin that is in the time, no, this is the time room, so I don't know, the space room, has the same spin. Okay, so now we want to study in some detail the, so I will not do, I'll sketch like the simplest examples, and then in the tutorial today, you will fill in the details that I will not do in the lecture. By the way, it should be clear, and I hope, that it doesn't matter whether I compare the two things at x or at x tilde. The only thing that matters is that the left-hand side and the right-hand side is at the same point. So this is, of course, the same as putting tildes everywhere. Because all I'm doing is just changing which point I'm comparing things at. OK? So in general, then let's see what kind of constraint this equation has to satisfy. Oh, another way of saying this, that will be clear, is that remember that we define variations of operators. As the difference between the transform operator at x and the original operator at x, okay? So this means that that equation fulfills the intuition that you already have. That equation is just a statement that now let's make an infinitesimal. Okay, this is an infinitesimal transformation. That equation infinitesimally is the statement that the variation of the correlator O1, A1, X1, ON, AN, XN vanishes. Which more explicitly tells you what is the variation of the product of fields. Variations satisfy the Leibniz rule. So this is the sum from 1 to N of the variation of the ith term on an xn equals 0. So that equation infinitesimally is just exactly the statement that if you vary the correlation function under the symmetry, it just vanishes. That's what invariance means. Okay. Good. So now we want to flesh out a little bit more in detail what this imposing invariance under conformal transformations implies. And We already developed in the last lecture and a half the transformation rules of primary operators. Well, it's written there. Okay, actually, yeah, it's written there. So let me write this useless but true formula for the time being. Well, it's not useless. So the left-hand side has to equal the right-hand side, but I know now what O tilde is in terms of O. That's what we were talking about in the last two lectures. Okay, it's because I called it phi there, it doesn't matter. So let's just spell out in glorious detail what this is, once and for all. And then this, okay. Is it clear what I did here?
Shouldn't the determinants be dx by dx theta by dx?
No, because it transforms like a tensor with lower indices. So
should they have different R?
No, it's the same. R is the same. It's a space-time transformation. So it's, I mean, you're rotating everyone the same way, right?
But it depends on the pi, which depends on the which space point.
No, no, of course. So this you have to evaluate the. But I'm saying that you're making a single transformation. It's x goes to x tilde, so everyone transforms in the same way.
Okay.
Good. So now what I want to do is study the consequences of this. So this would be true for an arbitrary primary operator that has dimension delta and is in a non-trivial representation of the Lorentz group specified by this index a. This looks a bit complicated, so let me just work out a couple of examples to see that things are not that complicated. And we'll start understanding the very special form that correlators of operators located at different points behave in a theory that is conformally invariant.
So,
yes?
Should we maybe have the tildes on the O's instead of the X's on the left-hand side?
No, I mean, I just substituted the right-hand side.
Uh-huh.
So the left-hand side is the left-hand side, right? I haven't seen anything.
Okay.
All that I did is transform the right-hand side.
Oh, you transformed the right-hand side. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Is that?
Shouldn't you have do that on x?
No. Okay. No.
Why?
Remember that.
Then you have g minus 1x.
Yes. So there are two ways of writing it. So you can write things, forget about all the fun indices. It can either be written this way, with x tilde is g of x, or it can be written with some, I use both interchangeably. Hopefully it's not too confusing. These are two completely equivalent ways of writing the transformation. But here on the right-hand side, I have O tilde, x tilde. That's why here I end up evaluating the x, not x. So let's scrutinize this equation for the one-point function of a scalar. So we'll start with scalar, so we don't have to worry about these matrices. So let's sequentially use, and there is a systematic way of doing it. I mean, there are several ways. You can either solve by inspection the finite form of the transformation, knowing the fact that you know all the elements in the equation, or you can solve it this way and write differential equations for the correlator, because this object vanishing is a differential equation for the correlation functions. These delta O's are differential operators, like I lost it. Okay, so delta O's are differential operators. You can just substitute delta O by precisely that expression in the first line in the second blackboard. And this will give you a differential equation for the correlator. And you can just systematically solve it. But here it's simple enough that by inspection of the finite transformation, we'll be able to determine the form of the correlator. So right now, what I'm interested in is the expectation, the one-point function of some operator of dimension delta. Sometimes I'll put the label, the quantum number of the operator. So let's sequentially use the various symmetries. So first of all, translational invariance. So what does translational invariance tell us about that?
It doesn't depend on x.
Good. So it means that it has to be a constant. From the infinitesimal form, that will be clear, because if I vary O with respect to translations, under translations, equals zero, and I use that formula, I just get that this is the same as A mu D mu of O delta of x equals zero, right? Which is just a statement that the expectation value is constant. It's x independent. Now I want to use scale invariance. So since it's constant, it's automatically Lorentz invariant, right? Because, yeah, I think that's clear. Now let's see at scale invariance. So I want to compare that equation. I guess I wrote it like this there. Where, let's see what is I have, where x tilde equals lambda equals x, right? That would be the statement that the one-point function is invariant under dilatation. Now, this guy is just a constant, right? Doesn't depend on the point at all. So I just substitute the expectation value for a constant. And now here I use the fact that I know how O tilde of X tilde transform. That's the business we've been doing the last day or so. Okay. Right? So that means that the right-hand side is lambda minus delta, the expectation value of O delta.
Tell me?
Yes.
Should there be an x tilde in the nulls?
Where?
The lambda to the minus delta.
No, this was the comment that we just did, that you can either have O tilde at x tilde equals O of X, or you can have O tilde of X equals O evaluated at G inverse X.
Shouldn't it be at the same space-time point, this transformation?
No, this is a transformation, isn't it? No, it's not the same space-time point. I mean, this was the formula that we've been using, in particular for Lorentz transformations, of how objects transform under under transformation. If you're happier this way, I'm happy to. What I was saying is that this would be equivalent to writing things like this. Are you happier with these forms, or you're not happy with it either? Or what?
I was mistaken before I saw
that. Okay. Of course, you can derive exactly the same equations by either putting tildes on the right or the left, or putting and tildes on the right and the left, and then you either use this equation or that equation, which are totally equivalent. So here I'm just using this transformation. So that gives me L minus delta, but I know what the expectation value of this guy is, just a constant. Okay. So how do we solve this equation? So dilatation invariance tells us that the value of the one-point function, which is C, has to equal lambda to the minus delta times C. So what is the solution to this equation? It's zero, except when? So the one-point function is either zero, if delta zero from zero, or it is a constant that you know can normalize to one. If you have an operator that has dimension zero, which operator has dimension zero? Which operator always exists in conformal field theory? You always have the identity operator. So it can be a constant, which is the identity. So we have discovered that any non-trivial, by non-trivial I mean non-identity operator, has a trivial, meaning zero, a one-point function in the full space. Yes.
So then a question would be, in this kind of setting, you can't have like symmetry breaking of normal computing.
No, you can, because here I'm computing vacuum expectation values in the state that's conformal invariant.
Yeah.
So that you can definitely have conformal field theories where you have a state that breaks conformal symmetry, and then the expectation value of the operator in that state is non-zero. But the way, and we will see this, the way you would think about, from the point of view of correlation functions, the way you would think about the expectation value of an operator in a non-trivial state, should I go? Let me just say it in words, and we will see much later in formula. The expectation value of an operator in non-trivial state is actually described by a three-point function acting on the vacuum, because any state, as I already briefly mentioned before, any state, trivial or non-trivial, the trivial one just will be obtained from the identity, is obtained by acting with an operator on the vacuum. So you can represent the non-trivial state by acting with an operator on the vacuum, the state that you're measuring things with, and the bra is also another operator acting in the vacuum. So that guy being non-zero is a statement that the three-point function on the vacuum can be non-zero. Yes?
Why is the identity the only operator when delta equals zero?
This is true in unitary conformal field theories. In principle, I think it's... I don't know of any example where there is an operator that has dimension zero that's not the identity, but definitely, and we will... Okay, at least in two dimensions, we will see explicitly that unitarity forces us, the fact that you have a Hilbert space of states that has a positive definite inner product will tell us that the only operator that has zero dimension is the identity. There's only one non-trivial operator. Okay, so maybe for those of you that want a slight challenge, I mean, it's still not... It's quite simple, but I think it might help crystallize this idea. Imagine now, so here I was considering a system that is completely translationally invariant. So I was living in RD. Okay. Now, in many physical systems, in condensed matter and statistical mechanics, it's very useful to consider a sample with a boundary. I mean, usually magnets have a boundary, so it's not an idealization. It's in practice, you have to deal with systems with boundaries. So imagine now, just for simplicity, because it's easier to write two dimensions than higher dimensions, you consider the system not in the full plane, but a system in the upper half plane. So we have coordinates, say x1 and x2. And you have a physical system that has a boundary at x2 equals 0. Okay. There are many physical systems that have this property. You can take a magnet and really put a boundary and study the dependence of thermodynamic quantities as a function of what kind of boundary condition you impose here. Okay. So the question I would like to ask you to try is to answer exactly the same question, namely, what would be the expectation value or the one-point function of a primary operator located at position x1, x2. So you have an operator here at position x1, x2. In a geometry where you have a boundary, a straight line boundary. Okay? So what is this? And you should be able to derive this by thinking a bit carefully about this construction I did here and thinking which constraints have to be lifted. So obviously, having a boundary breaks symmetry. I don't have translational invariance anymore in this direction, right? So what I want to do is go through this logic that I went through for the case of the full plane, for this particular case, and derive what is the possible behavior of the Rankine side in this case. And you will see that in this case, you can have a non-trivial one-point function. Okay. And this has, of course, many physical applications when you study systems with boundaries. Is the formulation of the problem semi-clear at least? Okay. So to try it, I think it's a fun little exercise. Okay, and now, but we're not done. Okay, no, so here we're done. Now let's do the two-point function. I'll do it in some detail, the two-point function, and then the higher ones I will sketch. But I think the logic will be transparent. So now I want to study the two-point function of two primary operators of dimension delta 1 and delta 2. Okay, so so translational invariance again. Okay, so what would translational invariance tell us about this?
Depends on the difference x1
minus. Depends on x1, 2. X2. What would rotational invariance tell us? It depends on the distance, right? Now let's study dilatations. So all I have to do is write down this formula. Okay, I guess I'm writing it like this. The two-point function of the original fields evaluated at the point has to be equated with the two-point function of the transformed fields at the same point. Okay? So we know that this guy is a function just from A and B, from translational rotational invariance. We know that this is a function of the distance, x1 and x2. Now I use the fact that I know how this guy transforms. I mean, I already wrote the formula there. So, okay, so can someone tell me what the right-hand side is? I already started giving you the hint.
Minus the sum.
Minus the sum, yes. Oh, sorry. So here I should be careful, right? So this is the function of the rescale distance, and this is OX1, OX2. Are we happy with this formula? Okay. So this equation, knowing that X tilde is lambda X, is the statement that F has to be a function that satisfies that f of lambda of x1 minus x2, which is where I'm using that x tilde is lambda x, has to equal lambda minus delta 1 plus delta 2 times a function of x1 minus x2. So by inspection, which function has this property?
Power.
Which power?
X1 minus x2 to the sum of the
dimensions. That's right. So we can indeed verify that this equation has the right homogeneity property. That's an important thing about conformal field theories. There is no microscope, there is no scale in the problem. So all correlators are homogeneous. There is no scale in the problem, so things just rescale with some overall power. There is no scale to compensate for that. So that's what this power law, I mean, I call this power law behavior compared to, so that, okay, so that means that the two-point function, as a consequence of these three symmetries, has this power law behavior. This is to be compared, say, with the two-point function in a massive theory, like a free massive scalar field. I mean, how would the behavior of a, say, phi, a massive scalar field phi at evaluated x1 and x2, how does it behave at very large distances?
Okay,
exponentially.
Exponentially,
how? No, but I'm looking for the sign. Is it a plus or a minus?
Minus,
yes. So this is versus in a massive theory. Massive being non-scaling, non-conformal. So here you have a scale, which is the mass. And then correlation functions have, at large distances, have exponential follows. Okay. Remember that in the first lectures I mentioned, and this is very important for statistical mechanics, that when you describe the behavior of a system near the critical point, in order to reach this scale invariant behavior, you have to tune the mass to zero, okay? Because then it's only then that you get recover some scale invariance.
Yeah.
And by sending the mass to zero, we remember that we got the correlation length, that we got the physical feature that the microscopic degrees of freedom of the system as you approach the critical point, which was controlled by sending the mass to zero, have fluctuations at all length scales. Okay. So this is just to highlight the difference between the behavior of correlators for conformal versus non-conformal theories. Okay. But we're not done yet, because now you might wonder whether special conformal transformations do something else. It could be that they constrain this equation further. And in fact, they do. They do. So one way of doing it, there's a clever way of doing it and a not correct but more painful way of doing it, which we would do exactly this analysis that we did here, just replacing x tilde now by the special conformal transformation. So if you remember, it was something unpleasant like this. Remember that we got this. This was the action of special conformal that we obtained by conjugating translations by inversion. So now all that you would have to do is using the fact that we know the two-point function, having used the constraints that we have used, plug this into here using the fact now that x tilde is this mess. Okay. There's a slicker way of doing it, which is not to impose a special conformal image, but to impose inversion. Remember that inversion is this discrete transformation that generates for you essentially the whole conformal group. Okay. And I think you'll have exercises to see this in more detail. Let me just give you a couple of highlights. So remember that an inversion maps X mu in that way. And in particular, under an inversion, an operator of dimension delta transforms like this. Right? That what you would have to do is compute the Jacobian of the transformation. I think we did that, or you will do that in the exercise, of just the Jacobian of the transformation dx dx tilde. You get that. So now what we can do is complete this analysis. So now let's, I can use that equation I have there, right? It's exactly the same equation. The only thing that changes now, of course, is that x tilde is different for a dilatation than for a special conformal transformation. So what you end up getting here is just that 1 over x minus 2 tilde to the delta 1 plus delta 2, which is the form of the two-point function that we derived, except that there it is evaluated at x tilde, has to equal 1 over x1 tilde, is that a square? Yes, sorry. 2 delta 1, 1 over x2 tilde delta 2. Times this, right? Which is 1 over x1 2 to the delta 1 plus delta 2. So now, how do we solve this equation? Now what I have to do is relate the distance of the inverted coordinates with the distance of the original coordinates. And it's really a direct consequence of the definition of inversion of that. So I'll write a formula that you can derive. It takes really two minutes, but I don't want to spend the time doing this now. I think you'll do it in the tutorial. You have this. This distance is related to the inverted distance with this non-trivial factor coming here. Okay. So now we can just put this together, and essentially the equation that you end up getting by essentially substituting this into here, you just end up getting just distribute the terms in, just substitute this here and write it in this way. So plug this here and distribute. So when is this equation satisfied? What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for this equation to be satisfied?
The equation you wrote, we have x to the power 4 over x to the power 2 and
sorry,
the other side.
This one?
X index.
No, this is two.
The same dimension.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I missed the question.
So the dimension, I'm talking about the dimension. So we have power four.
Look at the definition of inversion.
It's a job. It's still the equal to x mu over x.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so I'm still looking for someone to see what is the.
They have the same dimension.
Sir? Exactly. So this equation is satisfied even only if delta 1 equals delta 2. So we see that a special conformal symmetry further constrains the correlation, the correlator, the two-point function, and tells us that that's it. That's the final form of the correlator. And it is zero otherwise. If delta, okay, but that's what it means here. So if it's non-zero, if delta 1 equals delta 2, otherwise it's zero. So this gives us a very practical tool to obtain one of the objects that we're really interested in conformal field theories, which is this scaling dimension. We want to calculate the scaling dimensions in a conformal field theory for all the reasons that I already explained from the course. And a very practical way of doing this is precisely by computing in the plane, in RD, the correlation function of the two-point function of operators, and by reading off the fall-off, the power law fall-off of the correlator, we can extract these numbers. Okay. And that's a very practical tool to compute the dimensions of operators. Very good. I think today I'll go a little bit over time because I want to at least finish this part of the story. And so maybe tomorrow, I don't know, maybe tomorrow is too ambitious, but at least I want to finish the correlation functions of scalars. Once that you've seen the trick, I think if there was a prize at the end of the day, you would know how to compute it for the three-point function. And for the four-point function, there's a subtlety that I will describe. But in principle, the logic now you can extend to 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever point function that you want. So for the three-point function, I will not say much because it's almost identical, the derivation to what I did for the two-point function. So now the next thing, so we're going one-point function, two-point function, and the three-point function. Scalars. I'm still doing scalars just to make our life a bit simpler. So by now it should be quite clear that imposing, now we have an intuition of how to impose translational symmetry, rotational symmetry, and dilatation symmetry. We don't have that much intuition yet about inversion because these are unusual things, but. But just from the knowledge of these symmetries, you know that the correlation function can only depend on three distances, right? You have three points, there are three invariant distances. You have the distance between 1 and 2, between 1 and 3, and between 2 and 3. So not knowing anything better, you would write okay, I have to make sure that to be consistent with my notation here. Okay, I put the 2 here, I don't know why, but put 2 here, 3 here, so 2b. So here I'm already imposing dilatation symmetry. So the translational and rotational symmetry tells us that I have functions of these three invariant distances. And now if I impose dilatations, can someone tell me what constraints dilatations will impose on A, B, and C?
A plus B plus C is the sum of dimensions over 2.
Precisely. Because if I do a scale transformation, remember that every operator scales with the lambda to the minus delta. So the sum, and now if I transform these guys, it has to be that the sum, since all these guys transform exactly the same under dilatation, the sum of the exponents has to equal the sum of the dimensions. So that's precisely the statement that A plus B plus C equals delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3 over 2. Then the right-hand side will have exactly the right scaling transformation. It will scale precisely like 1 over delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3. And now, the thing that you can found, the thing that you would have to do now is check whether special conformal transformations impose further constraints. And we will see that the answer is yes. And the simplest way of checking this, again, is not by using that nastier looking special conformal transformations, but just use inversions. So impose inversions. And it's essentially line by line the same analysis that I did here. All that the only important formula that you have to use here is this one. The fact that in that formula you have distances, and you want to know how distances transform under inversion. So you just have to do a little bit of gymnastics and to see that 2a. I'll write the answer. Okay, now I have to fix. If I send these guys, I get, I think this is right, yeah, right? So you see that indeed, special conformal transformations further constrain the correlators to take a very specific form. So again, we see that the three-point function of primary operators, is the position dependent is completely fixed by symmetry. The only information is in this constant, which has a lot of physical information, so we have to compute it. And again, information about the dimension of the operator. Okay? To see that this is something not unreasonable, a nice thing to check would be to see that, imagine you take a free scalar field theory. Which is conformal. To compute the three-point function of this operator. Phi squared at x1, phi squared at x2. So clearly, hopefully clearly, any power of phi is a primary operator of free scalar field theory. A consistency check, well, I mean, that we derive from first principles, so it has to be correct. But to see it from a more kind of down-to-earth point of view, just take a free scalar field theory and compute the three-point function of this primary operator, phi squared. This is like the you tune the mass term to zero, but it's the three-point function of the mass operator. And see, just using Feynman diagrams, that indeed the dependence is exactly given by this. You would have to compute some Feynman diagram like this. So you have here x1, x2. So this funny thing is an operator phi squared. It has two legs coming out. Here I have the point x1. Here I have the point x2. Here I have the point x3.
Does the point x3 have phi squared as well?
Oh, yes. That would be the diagram you would have to compute. And just using the fact that you know what the propagator of a massless free scalar field is, you will see that you exactly recover that functional form. Is this clear? I didn't go through this final derivation, but it's really identical to that over there. And now very quickly, you would think that this story will continue forever, namely that by putting more operators, the functional position dependence of the operator is completely fixed, but luck ends here. And let me just sketch why. So now let's study four-point functions. And now here an interesting new thing happens. Okay. It turns out that when you have four or more points, so if you have given 4 points, you can construct, and I think this is in the tutorial, right? The cross ratios, I think so. Construct, you can construct conformally invariant ratios. Okay? So there are objects given the data of 4 vectors that are completely invariant under conformal transformations. So that means that at the very least, I should be able to put on the right-hand side a function of that ratio, because that ratio is invariant under conformal transformations, and therefore conformal symmetry doesn't fix the functional dependence of that cross ratio. Yes, these guys are called cross ratios, and you'll see why. So since time is short, let me just write down what these ratios are. So when you have 4 points, then there are 2 ratios that you can define. And again, to show the claim I'm going to make, all that you will have to ever use is this formula. Okay. So how things transform under inversion. So you can define 2 invariant quantities under conformal transformation, which is the distance between x1 and x2, the distance between 3 and 4, divided by the distance between 1, 3, and 2, 4, and eta 2, the distance between 1, 2, and 3, 4, divided by the distance between 2, 3, and 1, 4. So the invariance under the first 3 guys should be apparent. This is clearly invariant under translation. If I say something that you disagree, someone raise their hand. It's clearly invariant under rotations. It's clearly invariant under dilatations. And it's almost clearly invariant under inversions. All that you will have to do is plug in that formula that I have there. And notice that these funny factors that appear under inversion are exactly canceled between the numerator and the denominator. The point is that these factors 1, 2, 3, 4 appear with weight 1 in the numerator and denominator. So when you do the inversion, they will cancel out. Okay. And that's why these are conformal invariant. So that means that the 4-point function will be an unknown function that you will have to compute, and in every conformal field theory, and for every choice of observable, will be a different function. And we will compute these guys explicitly, say, in the Eisen conformal field theory and the Pott conformal field theory. This is some non-trivial functions. And they really can be non-trivial functions. They can be like hypergeometric functions and a really formidable disk. Times something that is really fixed by the rest. And this part is identical structurally to the part that we've seen for the 2 and the 3-point function. It's the product of all possible distances. X, I, j. OK, so I hope it's clear that this x1, 2, OK, hopefully this was clear. This was x1 minus x2, right? Well, I was using it before, so I hope it was clear before otherwise. So we have this, the product of all possible distances between 4 points, times 2 to the gamma ij. I don't want the 2 here. Gamma ij is a matrix, which is symmetric. And now all that you have to impose is scale invariance. So that means that the sum I less than j of gamma ij equals minus 2 delta I. Okay. This is the statement that the right-hand side has a scaling weight delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3 plus delta 4. Okay. And our and of course, if you go to higher endpoint functions, there are more and more cross ratios you can construct, and the correlations will depend on one or of on functions of these cross ratios.
Shouldn't be some on the right side?
No, because it's for fixed I. This has to be true. So for fixed I.
The sum over here.
Yes. Okay, how do you write this?
I'm
having over J with. That's horrible notation. For fixed I. Good, so let me stop here. I didn't get to the generalization of this when we study operators as not scalars. We will do that at the beginning of the next lecture. This is very important because at the very least, any conformal field theory has an operator that's not a scalar. So can someone tell me which operator exists in all conformal field theory? The stress tensor. So at the very least, we want to calculate the constraints imposed by conformal symmetry on correlators of the stress tensor. And also, we will do it for currents, which are vectors. OK, so I better stop here. Thank you.